Hello, this is Auntie Bee's Knees with your business report for the week of April 28th. The same week that Australian troops joined the U.S. to invade Iraq, U.S. trade negotiators arrived in Canberra, Australia to launch negotiations for an Australia-U.S. free trade agreement. Talks began the week of March 17th and will continue during the weeks of May 19th and July 21st. The negotiations stem from an initiative begun in June 2001, when 80 U.S. and Australian companies formed the American-Australian Free Trade Agreement Coalition, or AFTAC. AFTAC's purpose is to lobby the U.S. and Australian governments for a free trade agreement between the two countries. The members of this coalition include many of the same U.S. corporations that will profit directly from the war in Iraq, such as Bechtel, Boeing, Lockheed Martin, and Halliburton. Call it a coincidence if you like, but the timing of the trade talks puts both corporate motives for and Australia's role in the war into sharp relief. The U.S. and Australia are among the staunchest advocates of free trade policies in the world. Australia's Minister of Trade chairs the meetings of the Cairns Group, an organization of 17 agriculture exporting nations, including Canada, which lobbies for lowering restrictions on trade and agricultural commodities at the WTO and other multilateral trade bodies. The U.S. government has spearheaded the MIA, NAFTA, the Free Trade Area of the Americas, and a dizzying array of other multi- and bilateral trade agreements. In the current round of negotiations, Australia's trade priority is to export beef and other agricultural products to the U.S. The U.S. wants to boost its sales of computers, airplanes, cars, and pharmaceuticals in Australia, and to increase investment options for U.S. corporations on Australian soil. In exchange for tariff concessions on beef and other agricultural goods, the U.S. is demanding that Australia dismantle its federal drug benefits plan and eliminate the ability for Australia's Foreign Investment Review Board to control U.S. ownership in the media, entertainment, telecommunications, air travel, and banking industries. The U.S. is also expected to fight Australia's policy of labeling genetically modified foods and to demand changes in Australian quarantine regulations that serve to keep foreign diseases, plants, and animals out of Australia's unique ecosystem. The demands of the two countries at first seem strikingly uneven. In exchange for minor concessions on agriculture, the U.S. is demanding drastic changes to a wide range of Australian social and environmental policies. Partly, this disparity reflects the difference in size between the two economies. Australia's population is just 6% of U.S. numbers, and Australia's economy has a gross domestic product roughly equal to that of the state of Pennsylvania. But the U.S. is also able to press for extensive concessions because the free trade talks have been so eagerly pursued by the Australian government. Australia relies on U.S. imports and, in fact, provides the U.S. with its second-largest trade surplus in a time of record U.S. trade deficits. While Australia is the 15th largest export market for the U.S. is the second largest export market for Australian goods. The U.S. is the largest foreign investor in Australia, while Australia is the 8th largest investor in the U.S. Not only does Australia rely on a steady stream of U.S. goods and services, but Australia also recently signed a preferential taxation agreement with the U.S. This agreement, which takes effect July 1st, gives Australian companies with U.S. subsidiaries level pegging for dividends with the U.S. UK, which has the most competitive U.S. tax treaty in the world. Like the free trade agreement, the treaty on double taxation was the result of prolonged lobbying by a number of corporate groups, including the American-Australian Business Council. More significantly, Australia's Liberal government is already opposed to most of the regulations the U.S. wants to overturn through a free trade agreement. The agreement thus provides a convenient cover for the Australian government to privatize and deregulate communications, pharmaceuticals, and air travel under the rubric of international diplomacy and freer trade. Australia's Prime Minister John Howard has been an ardent supporter of U.S. economic and foreign policies, going so far as to describe himself as Washington's quote-unquote deputy sheriff in the Asia-Pacific region. With this kind of language in use, it's no surprise that the Howard government is seeking a free trade agreement that will not only deliver Aussie beef to America, but also strengthen military and security ties between the two nations. Tucked into Australia's demands for the free trade agreement are measures to improve cooperation in the investigation and prevention of customs violations and to pursue the harmonization of customs policies, data, technologies, and procedures. As we all know, customs regulates not only the passage of goods across borders, but also the movement of people. So-called harmonization of customs policies between Australia and the U.S. is alarming considering that both governments have instituted harsh new immigration, refugee, and visa policies since September 11, 2001. Taiwan. Both countries currently implement a policy of detaining asylum seekers in prisons until their refugee claims can be processed. It's still early in the negotiation process, and public opposition in both countries is emerging. If community organizations, unions, student bodies, and political groups can unite against the Australia-U.S. Free Trade Agreement on the grounds that it presents a major threat to social and environmental policies as well as human rights, there is a chance that this agreement can be defeated. Andy Beasneys will be sure to keep you posted. The head of the United Nations Oil for Food program in Iraq has warned against foreign domination of Iraq's oil fields, arguing that the Iraqis have the ability to operate the industry without foreign interference and should have the right to control their own resources. According to Benon Sevan, the Iraqis, quote, can run their country given the freedom and the control over their natural resources. They've been able to do so even under the most restrictive sanctions regime and most restrictive government, end quote. Iraq has the world's second largest proven crude oil reserves. 2 decades of war and 12 years of UN sanctions have left Iraq's oil industry in a shambles, but the country's petroleum engineers and executives have nonetheless been able to manage the oil industry relatively efficiently despite the desperate lack of equipment and investment. Before the war, Iraq produced 2.6 million barrels of oil per day, exporting more than 2 million barrels of this. The UN's Oil for Food program, established in 1996 to help Iraqi people cope with the sanctions imposed after Saddam Hussein's 1990 invasion of Kuwait, has been the only legal outlet for Iraq to export this oil. The program allowed Iraq to sell unlimited quantities of oil, provided the proceeds were used to pay for humanitarian aid, reparations for the Gulf War, or spare oil field parts. However, many parts contracts were put on hold because the U.S. complained that such items could have military uses. Sevan's recent comments come as the U.S. has moved to restart oil operations in Iraq following the U.S.-led attack. The U.S. wants to use the profits from Iraqi oil to finance reconstruction projects there. These projects are being funded by the U.S. Agency for International Development and contracted out to U.S. firms such as Bechtel and Halliburton. As part of this plan, the U.S. wants to establish a U.S.-led advisory team to reopen Iraq's oil ministry. This interim authority would take control of Iraq's oil sales under the supervision of the World Bank or the International Monetary Fund. The U.S. also wants sanctions lifted and the Oil for Food program canceled as of its June 3rd expiration date, so that U.S. oil extracting and military equipment can more easily flow in and out of Iraq. The U.S. is facing its stiffest opposition from Russia, China, and France, those same countries that most staunchly opposed the war, and the same nations who profited from the UN Oil for Food program by buying into Iraqi oil field repair and drilling contracts negotiated with the Hussein government. Russia is determined to fight to secure the contracts it signed with the former Iraqi regime for the development of Iraq's oil reserves, and wants UN Secretary General Kofi Annan to run the entire reconstruction program, including taking charge of Iraqi oil sales and development of its oil fields, until an internationally recognized Iraqi government comes into power, a process U.S. officials say could take several years. France has proposed temporarily suspending sanctions and then gradually phasing out the Oil for Food program. Meanwhile, the U.S. government's acknowledged objective is to support American companies such as ExxonMobil and Chevron Texaco, which were shut out of the Iraqi oil sector before the war, by reopening existing contracts to companies from the U.S. The resumption of Iraq's oil production ought to be technically possible within a few months, but the dispute over who will control the oil provides a major obstacle to resuming Iraq's oil exports. International traders are afraid that they will procure oil from parties who are not the legal owners. A future government could declare these contracts null and void, forcing oil buyers to pay twice for deliveries. Since the outset of the war, major international law firms have advised oil companies and intermediaries to wait until the establishment of an interim authority or even a democratically elected government before investing in Iraq. It remains to be seen which oil companies will be the first and fiercest in taking the plunge. And lastly, over the past 3 weeks, the U.S. Treasury Department has revealed that dozens of U.S.-based corporations and organizations have been fined for doing illegal business with alleged terrorists and drug traffickers. Did I just say that Chevron Texaco had been shut out of the Iraqi oil industry? Guess I was wrong, because it's one of the companies accused of breaking the sanctions against Saddam Hussein's Iraq. Chevron Texaco was fined after it was discovered that the company bought oil from Iraq under the UN Oil for Food program, but made a payment to an Iraqi government management port official. Chevron Texaco joins the New York Yankees and Walmart, who have been caught doing business in Fidel Castro's Cuba, and banking behemoth Citigroup, discovered to have financed terrorist groups. With a few exceptions, it is against the law for U.S. companies and individuals to have commercial or financial dealings with about a dozen countries and countless organizations allegedly involved in dictatorships, terrorism, or drug trafficking. Each year, the U.S. government investigates thousands of cases of alleged violations of the Trading with the Enemy Act and other statutes and executive orders that restrict free trade. Each year, the U.S. government imposes millions of dollars in civil penalties and prosecutes 10 or so criminal cases. On April 4th, the U.S. Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Asset Control named 57 companies and organizations in violation of sanctions laws. The lawbreakers are being hit with fines ranging from $500 to $250,000. Beyond this, information provided by the government about these violations is paltry. As one critic points out, there is, quote, no way of knowing if the companies sold brass knuckles to the secret police or baby formula to an orphanage, end quote. The largest penalty levied among the cases was $250,000 against Zim American Israeli Shipping Company of Norfolk, Virginia, for trading with Cuba. Zim, which is partially owned by the Israeli government, is one of the largest shipping companies in the world. Norwegian-owned shipping company Stolt-Nielsen Transportation Group of Greenwich, Connecticut, was fined $95,000 for an illegal fund transfer to Sudan. The New York Yankees were fined $75,000 for signing contracts for Cuban ball players in which the Cuban government had an interest. And Walmart was fined $50,000 for its dealings with Cuba. A Walmart spokesman says some pajamas sold to its Canadian operations might have originated in Cuba. In contrast, Citigroup was fined less than $3,000 for violating U.S. laws against financing terrorism, and the International Union of Pure and Applied Chemistry in Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, was fined just $500 for violating U.S. laws against the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. This was the only penalty on the U.S. government's list for violations of nonproliferation laws. And that's a wrap for this week's Business Report. Signing off, this is Auntie Bee's Knees urging you to put your money where your mouth is and invest ethically.